Hey everybody, welcome to Morbidology. I'd like to take a second to thank my new Patreon supporters, Lindsay Raggio, Claire Louise Mahoney, and Sierra Crescenzo. In return for your support on Patreon, you get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, ad-free and early release episodes, true crime articles, polls, and you can even request a case for me to cover on the podcast. The support on Patreon truly helps out, and I am eternally grateful. I mentioned it last week, but Morbidology has been selected as a finalist in the True Crime category at the Discover Podcast Awards 2020. If you guys would like to vote for me to win, that would be amazing. I've included the link in the show notes, and it literally takes 10 seconds. I also have some very exciting news for you guys as well. Over the past 6 months, I've been working on a new investigative true crime podcast series, which will be launched on the 23rd of November. It's called The Shattered Window and covers the unsolved murder of Jacqueline DeWallaby. I'm about to play the promo, so give it a listen and please subscribe wherever you're listening. The murder of Jacqueline DeWallaby is a tragedy that has puzzled and polarized the minds of those who know it. Over the past 6 months, we've extensively investigated this case, trawling through files, trial transcripts, and archives, and have been conducting interviews with the people who've lived through it.
It was a sensational, startling fact that a 7-year-old little girl had shown up missing from a suburban home.
Something like that happening would have never crossed our parents' minds.
The notion that a stranger can slip into a child's bedroom in the middle of the night, completely undetected, is surely a notion that every single parent on this earth fears. But what's even more lamentable is knowing that a child killer is roaming the street, and even more chilling, they could be someone you know.
Hosted by Emily G. Thompson and Eileen McFarlane, this is The Shattered Window. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Amity is a small farming and logging town in Maine of around 200, located near the Canadian border. It is the kind of location people seek out for a quiet and peaceful life. It has not one single store, gas station, or even a traffic light. In 2010, a shocking murder was discovered inside a mobile home, leaving residents of the sparsely populated community anguished at how such a brutal crime could have happened in their tiny community. It was around 9:30 p.m. on the 23rd of June 2010 when the brother and father of 30-year-old Jason Dehan went to his mobile home on Route 1 in Amity. Jason was supposed to visit his parents' house a short distance down Route 1. However, he never showed up. According to his wife, Crystal, He had left their home and hadn't returned. So where was he? His brother and father decided to check in with Jason's neighbour, 55-year-old Jeffrey Ryan, who lived just a couple of doors down. Jeffrey and Jason were the very best of friends and hung out together almost daily. They knocked on the front door of Jeffrey's home but received no response. They attempted to open the door and found that it was unlocked. They peeked their heads through and called out to Jeffrey but heard no reply. The home was eerily silent. As they made their way from room to room, they came across the back bedroom. In here, they were met by a distressing scene. It was the body of Jeffrey's 10-year-old son, Jesse. They ran from the home and called 911. When police arrived at the scene, Jesse was pronounced dead. They then discovered the body of Jeffrey in a small woodshed beside the home and the body of Jason at the end of the driveway. All three victims had been brutally stabbed to death. Jason was a married father of three and worked as a drywall hanger. In his world, his family was the sun that he orbited around. He loved spending time with his children and he taught them about the great outdoors. He worked alongside his father and brother in the family business and was an avid outdoorsman who loved hunting, fishing and riding ATVs. Jeffrey was a disabled veteran who had served in the Vietnam War and had been left unable to work due to the disability. Jeffrey and the mother of Jesse, Jamie Merrill, had been married for 7 years before divorcing around 3 years before the murders. The two shared custody of Jesse, but he lived primarily with Jeffrey, who was said to be a doting father who did his very best to provide for his son. Jesse wasn't Jeffrey's only child. He had 5 other children. He had a 16-year-old daughter named Maria with Tamara Strout. He and Tamara had been together for 9 years, and according to Tamara, they had started talking about giving the relationship another go, and in fact, had even been chatting about getting married. According to those who knew him, Jeffrey was a practical joker who loved to go on hunting and fishing trips with Jesse and grow his own vegetables. Quite often, Jason would come along for the trips, and they all really bonded over their love for the outdoors. The father and son duo also loved watching NASCAR together. Jesse had been a student at Hodgson Mills Road School. He was known as being an extremely bright and funny young boy, as well as a very social child who loved nothing more than being in the outdoors with his dad. When he returned to school after one of the trips, it was all he would talk about, and it was evident that he cherished these moments with his father. Jesse was also known as the class clown, who people could count on to make them laugh. Jesse loved playing in the treehouse that Jeffrey had built for him outside their home, as well as roasting marshmallows in the fire pit. Jesse also loved spending time with his cousins. They especially enjoyed playing in the woods. His aunt, Arlene Merrill, said that he was a massive prankster. In February, Jesse had gone to Lewiston to live with his mother, but around a week before the murders, he had returned to Amity to spend some time with his father. After the bodies were discovered, it was noticed that Jeffrey's pickup truck was missing, and investigators quickly theorized that whoever had committed the murders had then fled in the pickup truck. State Police spokesman Steve McCausland read out a statement stating that the driver is a person of interest and should be considered dangerous. It was identified as a blue and silver 1989 Ford F-150 pickup truck with main registration 4155RY. The home was cordoned off while police scene technicians were called to the scene, where outside, a treehouse, a child's bicycle and a trampoline showed signs of happier times. Meanwhile, the three bodies were taken to the medical examiner's office in Augusta, where autopsies were scheduled to be conducted. Since Amity is near the Canadian border, investigators notified US-Canadian border crossing and a ruse took, and Washington counties were also notified. Investigators speculated that the murders had taken place in the early morning hours of the Wednesday, meaning that the killer, or killers, had a full day to flee, and it was very possible that they may have driven over the border. The shocking murders left the small town feeling on edge.
Well, neighbors near this home and family of the victim say this is both horrifying and frightening. Horrifying because of the nature of the crime, and frightening because they say they don't know who the person responsible is and where that person might be.
The murders were extremely brutal, and many shuddered at the thought of the kind of person who could murder a 10-year-old child. Larry Hamilton, who lived in the same neighborhood, said, "Somebody has to be pretty cold to stab a kid. That's what bothers everybody so much, that there was a kid involved." When investigators spoke with the neighbors, they all said that they had not heard anything suspicious on the night of the murders. A makeshift memorial was assembled at the side of the road outside the home, which included three crosses for the victims. Meanwhile, a counselling session was held at the Hodgson Mills Road School, where Jesse was a student. The session was to help students cope with the tragic death and for any questions they may have to be answered. Around 20 students came to speak with counsellors, teachers, clergy, and other school staff members. During the two-hour session, teachers and pupils fondly recalled memories of Jesse. Brenda Adams, a teacher, told those in attendance that she would sell pencils for 10 cents to her students if they forgot one. She laughed when she said the business had dropped off a little bit. She soon discovered that the reason was because Jesse had been selling pencils for 10 cents. The students were welcome to share any stories or memories of Jesse, as they created a book filled with those memories, as well as cards and photo collages, which would be given to his family. More than 20 state police investigators and others from various law enforcement agencies were assigned to work on the case, while residents of Amity were asked to remain vigilant and report any suspicious behaviour or activity to police. Early on in the investigation, a motivation was put forward by Jamie, the mother of Jesse. According to Jamie, Jeffrey sold prescription medication out of his home. She spoke with the Associated Press and said that she had felt worried for Jesse because of this. She also said that Jeffrey had recently acquired the pickup truck by swapping drugs for it. Following Jamie's claims, investigators announced that they were aware of what Jamie had claimed in regards to the drugs, and said that she had divulged some of that information to them as well. However, they remained tight-lipped about whether or not they believed that drugs may have been involved in the murders. Jeffrey had 5 children, and when Jamie's claims of drug dealing wandered through the small town, his son, Shannon Ryan, came forward in his defense. He accused Jamie of taking cheap shots at his father because of their troubles over the years. According to Shannon, he would be extremely surprised if his father was selling drugs. He stated, "The biggest thing I have been dealing with is all these negative things about my father. My father had 2 things in his life, his home and his son." A criminal background check on Jeffrey revealed no history of drug-related offences. He additionally said that he believed his father most likely knew the killer because he owned 2 Rottweilers who wouldn't take too kindly to a stranger entering the home, and he also had several guns inside the home. Furthermore, Jeffrey and Jason could easily have defended themselves, which made people theorize that whoever committed the murders must have known them. As Shannon said, "No way could one person overpower 2 guys." Furthermore, nothing inside the home had been stolen. Just 2 days after the murders, Jeffrey's pickup truck was discovered in Weston, around 15 miles from Amity. The vehicle had been abandoned and then set on fire. Rumors began circulating that a body had been discovered inside the burnt-out car. However, this was nothing more than a rumor. The following day, 20-year-old Thane Ormsby was arrested and charged with the 3 murders. According to investigators, Thane was linked to the crime scene via DNA and fingerprints. His DNA and fingerprint had been discovered on a can of beer found inside the kitchen, as well as on a cigarette butt. Thane had been arrested in Dover, New Hampshire, and had made a full confession to the murders. At the crime scene, investigators had collected evidence which included the beer cans and cigarette butts. Forensic testing on the items revealed a full DNA profile of an unknown male, which would later be linked to Thane. At the time of the murders, Thane had been living in Orient with Robert and Joy Stroud, just a short distance from the crime scene. Robert was the father of Tamara Stroud, who Jeffrey had a 16-year-old daughter with named Maria. Thane had met the Stroud family because his mother, Maria Ormsby, had been a longtime friend of Tamara. Thane had moved in with the older couple because they were both disabled and he had been helping out with their cooking, cleaning, and tending to their birds. As is routine in a murder investigation, those closest to the victims were interviewed first. When Tamara spoke with investigators, she had told them that Thane was living with her parents for the past several weeks. But the day after the murder, Robert had driven him to Dover to stay with a relative. Originally, Robert told investigators that he had gone to Dover himself. When presented with this evidence, Robert admitted that he had driven Thane to Dover. When Thane was first of all interviewed by investigators, he claimed that he had met Jeffrey once, and the only time he had been to his home was around 2 or 3 weeks before the murders. He claimed that when he was there, he had drunk a can of beer and left it on the kitchen sink. He claimed he had never met Jason or Jesse, and he voluntarily gave investigators his DNA and fingerprints. During the interview, he was extremely cavalier and even spoke about the type of person who could commit such a gruesome crime.
All right, have a seat. Do you understand you're not under arrest?
Yes, I understand. Okay. I mean, I'd be a little bit shocked if I were under arrest, to tell you the truth.
I'm
here to cooperate.
Can you think of any good reason for something like this to happen?
Any good reason for something like this to happen? No, I cannot think of any good reason something like that could happen.
The following day, the state's police crime lab informed investigators that Thane's DNA and fingerprints matched the DNA and fingerprints found on a can of beer that was retrieved from the kitchen sink in Jeffrey's home, as well as from a cigarette butt that was found in the ashtray on the kitchen table. When the match was made, Thane was arrested and Robert was brought in for questioning once again. Investigators believed that Robert knew more than what he was letting on and was potentially even covering for Thane. In fact, a witness had come forward to say that they believed that they may have seen Jeffrey's car being dumped. According to the witness, he and his girlfriend were driving along Bancroft Road in Weston, which is where Jeffrey's burned out car was found. The witness claimed that he saw a maroon four-wheel drive Dodge stopped at the entrance to the field road leading to where the car was found. He told investigators he saw a male get out of the truck and head towards the wood, carrying a container out in front of him with two hands. He said it appeared as though the male was trying to prevent whatever was in the container from spilling out. According to the witness, the vehicle looked like the same vehicle that was owned by Robert. Furthermore, he saw the truck head towards Danforth, leaving the male behind as he walked into the woods. When investigators went to speak with Robert at his home in Orient, they noticed footwear impressions on the ground outside which looked similar to the footwear impressions they had seen next to Jeffrey's burned-out truck. When presented with this evidence, Robert confessed to investigators. He said that on the 22nd of June, or the 23rd of June, he couldn't recall which, he was sitting on his porch when Thane came through the woods. He immediately noticed that his clothing and his bike was covered in blood. Thane approached Robert and said that he had murdered Jeffrey, before chillingly stating, "I killed them all." According to Robert, Thane told him that he needed to get rid of Jeffrey's truck. He ordered Robert to follow him to Tamara's home on Springer Road. Investigators believe that Thane went into Tamara's home, still wearing the bloodstained clothing. Robert said that Thane then came out of her house, wearing only his underwear, after burning the stained clothing in Tamara's furnace. Tamara hadn't been home at the time. From here, Robert followed Thane as he drove Jeffrey's pickup truck out to the location where it was burned. Robert told investigators that after setting fire to the vehicle, Thane then ran back to his vehicle, climbed in, and said, "It's done." On the way back to Orion, Thane ordered Robert to drive to Ormsby, where he disposed of a knife in a bog. Robert claimed that he only helped Thane because he had threatened to kill him and his family if he did not comply. Thane had given a full confession to the murders and detailed what had happened.
"This is the first time I've cried."
"Yeah. Let it out. It's a lot to absorb, buddy. It's a lot to process. I'm gonna go get him his coffee."
"No, good. Since you don't know, if you decide to answer questions now, without a lawyer present, you have the right to stop answering at any time. Stop answering any time until you can talk to a lawyer. Do you understand that?"
"Yes."
"You do. Now, having all these rights I've just explained to you in mind, do you wish to answer questions at this time?"
"Yes, sir."
"You do. Where do you want to start?"
"Where would you like to start?"
"When did you go up there that night?"
"Tuesday night."
"Tuesday night? What
before
time
dark.
Was it? Before dark?"
"Six, seven."
"Jason was there at this point?"
"Jason was there."
"Is that the first time you met him?"
"That was the first
okay.
time."
"Okay. What happened?" "You're on your pedal bike?"
"I was on my pedal bike."
"Okay. What happened?"
"I mean, how detailed do you want to be?"
"As much as you can."
"So what, just walk through your memories." "Yeah. Then. What are you?"
"Walk me through it."
"Yeah. I'm already guilty. I might as well."
"Right."
"Okay, so I'll start from the beginning. I show up, and my idea is to kill Jeff Ryan, take his truck, and kill Alvin Silsby because I... they were bad people and they hurt people, and mm-hmm. I didn't."
He said that he was motivated to kill Jeffrey because he believed that he was selling drugs. He explained to the investigators that he had told Jeffrey that he was planning on camping in the woods, and Jeffrey told him that he had some nails in the shed, which he could take with him.
"So like I said, everything was going fine, and we were talking about, I'd been talking about spending the winter in the forest, just camping out."
"In the forest, you
yeah,
said? Okay.
Building a hut."
"Sure."
"And he said, oh, I got nails. He took me to the shed to show me nails, and I stabbed him in the back."
"He said, stop it." "Okay.
Yeah.
You don't say anything to him."
"Okay.
He's down. And you
I
leave
go
him
back
there.
In. I leave him there, and I go back in. I stabbed Jason, and Jesse ran to the back room."
Thane told the investigators that he had stabbed Jeffrey to death in the woodshed beside the house. After killing Jeffrey, Thane said that he went back inside his home and found Jason and Jesse sitting on the couch. He said that he stabbed Jason once and left him to bleed to death on the couch.
"Jesse ran to the back room. So I chased Jesse, and he was the quickest. He just said he was scared. The families don't need to know that."
"No, we do."
He then turned his attention to Jesse. Thane said that Jesse was terrified and attempted to run away. He chased him into the back bedroom where he stabbed him to death. After killing Jesse, Thane noticed that Jason wasn't on the couch where he had left him. Jason was still clinging to life and had managed to get out the front door.
"He ran down the road and I chased him down the road, and that's why he was in the ditch. He didn't understand because obviously I had just met him and there was no reason to him.
You really only met him the very first time?"
"It was really the first time I met him."
"Yeah. Did you do something else besides stab him?"
"I cut his throat."
"You cut his throat? How many times did you cut his throat?"
two, maybe three slashes.
Thane offered no explanation as to why he killed Jason and Jesse, and even referred to them as perfectly innocent. Thane said that he wanted to kill Jeffrey because it would rid the world of a bad person. He said that he didn't plan on killing Jason or Jesse, but they were witnesses who could identify him, and he didn't want to get caught for murder. According to Thane, following the murders, he had planned to move in with Tamara and Maria, who was Jeffrey's teenage daughter. Thane had been dating Maria.
I mean, obviously the families need to know what happened. They deserve an apology. It won't mean much.
Yeah, I was going to say, what should we tell the family? What do you want us to tell the family? What do you want us to tell the little boy's mother?
That it wasn't personal. That it wasn't to hurt her, that I'm sorry. What can you tell her, honestly?
I don't know.
I can't bring him back from the dead. You can't send me to Hades.
No. But you put him there. You killed his son. What do you want us to say to the mother? Or what do you want us to say to Jason's wife and three little kids? He has three kids, what, one, two, and ten or something. Anything you want us to tell those kids? Other than the fact you're just trying to see if you're proficient or not? Anything else you want to say as we wrap up our interview?
I know, sorry, it's not good enough.
No, I know, but you can throw it out there.
I'm more curious about anything than, I don't need to know, I'm just more curious. What would happen if you got away with this? If we didn't catch you, would you have continued? You think you would have done this again?
No.
Would you have gone and found that other guy that you had on your list?
Not any time this decade.
No.
I was completely ready to settle for a normal life.
Towards the end of the interview, Thane even joked about how a cell in prison would be smaller than the interview room, and even suggested that something good could come out of his actions.
My quarters are smaller than this. I probably won't have a window. Not that there'd be anything to see.
Yeah.
You know, best possible outcome.
Okay.
Honestly.
Yeah.
That good things could grow where evil was destroyed. You might not see it like that, but it's quite possible that these families will now become closer or stronger where they weren't. Mm-hmm. That maybe those children might be better growing up without their father. Mm-hmm. As for the boy, he was so young. Too young. But from what I understand, he too was well on his way to Thomaston. Here I am ready to go to prison, but as for me, I have a feeling what's going to happen is I'm either going to die in prison or be committed to a death sentence.
The arrest of Thane did very little in answering the question as to why. Why did he murder three innocent people? He claimed that he believed that Jeffrey was a drug dealer, but that doesn't warrant getting murdered so viciously. Moreover, if that were the real motivation, then why did he kill Jesse and Jason? A number of family members of the victim came forward to say that Thane did know Jeffrey. After all, he was dating Jeffrey's daughter, Maria. Some relatives even suggested that Jeffrey did not want Thane moving in with Maria. According to investigators, they were still investigating the relationships between all of the key players, and we're still looking into potential motives. The Right or Wrong podcast is a chapter-based fiction serial that invites the audience to participate in the craft of storytelling. With a focus on original tales of the unexpected, host Patrick Emile presents bi-weekly installments of exciting audio plays, leads spirited discussion with a bullpen of diverse co-hosts, and ultimately offers two prompts of plot continuation. Listeners can then vote online for what they feel is the strongest choice, with the winning prompt guiding the story's forward direction. The Right or Wrong podcast is available on all major podcast platforms, as well as rightorwrongpodcast.com. I'm about to play a clip of the show, so make sure that you're subscribed.
Think of a favorite show. Have you ever wondered what the writers were thinking? Or how you might have done things differently? Welcome to Right or Wrong.
Get your mom!
It's chaos. Rory dives out of the way as Chalmers lunges towards Marky and Tasia and begins firing. Most of the crew runs out of the house in all directions, having not signed up.
I mean, I've got my own thoughts on where I think you should go, but just by the writing.
I do think that a supernatural aspect would be beneficial, given what has been set up.
Right.
Tonally, structurally, all that.
Mm-hmm.
However, I'm not sure if you know the question.
Back at Gruberton's headquarters after a successful gig.
So I say to this knucklehead, look.
Don't get all riled up, Creamy.
Oh, okay, very funny.
You've related this account to us on several prior occasions.
Just the way it's told, it felt like a comic book. Like I could see the stills of each character in some kind of pose. They had their own music. They had their own theme.
Mm-hmm. Very much what I was going for.
It's so
only
clear.
One way to find out. Join us brave listeners in our writer's room. Welcome to Right or Wrong.
As Thane's mugshot was plastered across newspapers statewide, many people were trying to comprehend what would make such a young man snap. According to a neighbour of Thane, who met him just days after the murder, he briefly spoke with Thane in the car park of the apartment where he was staying. He said that Thane started talking about how he was an alcoholic and how he got extremely vicious when drunk. Reverend Lewis Glidden from St. Stephen the Martyr Anglican Church also came forward and gave a little insight into his character. He told the Associated Press that in December he had allowed Thane to move in with him at the rectory because he had no place to go, but eventually he had to kick Thane out. When the Reverend was in China, several women who were working in the rectory contacted him to express their fear of Thane. The women said that they were afraid of his angry outbursts. Furthermore, a small amount of cash had vanished, and Thane had disappeared for a week with the Reverend's car. Ultimately, the Reverend felt he had no choice but to ask Thane to leave. According to the Reverend, when he looked into Thane's eyes, he saw a demon staring back. He said that Thane was plagued by anger and was capable of being very intimidating. As he said, a demon right out of hell at times had control of Thane. You would have to see a person's eyes to see the force take control. The Reverend came to believe that Thane had two personalities, one that was manipulative and deceitful, and another which was helpless and in need of support. In fact, Thane had been sporadically homeless and relied on the generosity of other people who would allow him to live with them for periods of time. For a while, Thane had lived in Farmington at the home of Republican congressional candidate John Farry. He was one of three live-in campaign aides to Farry, who described him as being hardworking, unfeelingly polite, and knowledgeable. However, he also described him as immature and unmotivated. According to Frary, he and Thane had parted ways the year before the murder after an argument over an overloaded washing machine. He said that despite Thane's peculiarities, he never heard him speak of violence. However, he said that he didn't speak well of his family. Frary would compare Thane to Tom Ripley, the main character in the 1999 film The Talented Mr. Ripley. He said that Thane did not come from wealth, but had no trouble mingling with the affluent. As he said, he acquired their speech, their mannerisms. He did that very easily and very quickly. Following his arrest, Thien was ordered to be held without bail in New Hampshire, pending extradition proceedings. Shortly thereafter, he waived his extradition from New Hampshire and was then indicted on 3 counts of murder and 1 count of arson. As preparations for extradition were underway, it was revealed that Robert had told investigators that the murders followed a confrontation over a $10,000 drug debt. According to Robert, Thien had told him that Jeffrey owed his father $10,000 on a drug deal. By this point in the case, many people were wondering why Robert hadn't been charged. He had assisted Thien in disposing of evidence and hadn't called police. In fact, when he drove Thien to Dover, he drove him to his own son's house. If he had just threatened his family, and he knew that Thien had just killed 3 people, why did he take him to his own son's house? A background check of Robert revealed that he had a criminal history dating back to 1966. In 1966, Robert was convicted of taking a motor vehicle without the consent of the owner and served 3 months in jail. In 1972, he was convicted of misdemeanor interfering with an officer and paid a $100 fine. Then 3 years later, he was convicted of misdemeanor disorderly conduct and paid a $25 fine. He had also been convicted of a number of offences in Ellsworth and Aurora, including trespassing, criminal trespassing, discharging a firearm near a dwelling, and reckless hunting. According to Robert Deehan, the father of Jason, he believed that Thien didn't act alone in the murders and believed that charges should be filed against Robert for assisting an offender. Although Jesse's mother, Jamie, had criticized Jeffrey in the past and even suggested that drugs were involved, she too didn't believe that Thien had acted alone. She said that she couldn't believe that a 20-year-old would get it into his mind to kill Jeffrey, Jason, and Jesse alone. She said, "We know that he did not get rid of evidence of the crime alone. The police have said that, and I think this was planned beforehand, and Ormsby didn't act alone." Jamie also revealed that Jeffrey had problems with Robert in the past, and these problems had stemmed from the on-and-off relationship that Jeffrey had with his daughter, Tamara. However, Robert's wife, Joy, staunchly denied any problems between the family. Investigators once again stated that it was an ongoing murder investigation and that they could not discuss certain things publicly, such as whether or not more charges were going to follow. They additionally stated that the autopsy reports had still not been completed. On the 12th of July, Thien was extradited back to Maine and booked into the Aroostook County Jail in Holden. During his arraignment, he pleaded not guilty to 3 counts of murder and 1 count of arson. The state requested that a forensic psychiatric evaluation be conducted on Thien to help determine his state of mind at the time of the murders. There was no real update in the case until the 11th of September, when it was announced that Robert had been arrested and indicted on charges of hindering apprehension and arson. Robert pleaded not guilty and was subsequently released on bail. His release came with conditions. He was not allowed to contact members of the victims' families. The update was crushing to the victims' families. Shannon said that they had been waiting for the arrest for 2 months, and for him to be released so easily was a kick in the teeth. The case was slowly making its way through the justice system, and then in April of 2011, it was announced that attorneys for Thien had filed paperwork seeking to suppress statements that he had made to police following his arrest. Attorneys James Dunleavy and Sarah LeClaire said that they wanted to suppress the statements based on factors surrounding Miranda rights. They stated that Thien wasn't properly Mirandized and that if he waived his right to an attorney, he did so involuntarily or unknowingly. Assistant Attorney General Bill Stokes announced that their position was that the interviews conducted satisfied all state and federal standards and that everything was done properly and that Thien was made fully aware of his rights. A hearing was scheduled to deal with the request to suppress the statements. During the hearing, it was revealed for the first time that the three victims had been murdered with a combat knife, and that the knife had been recovered in the bog where Robert had told investigators it was. Detectives Dale Keegan and Adam Stoymatter had interviewed Thane in regards to the murders. During the first interview, Detective Keegan had informed Thane that he was not under arrest and did not read him his Miranda rights. He said that Thane voluntarily answered questions and submitted DNA and fingerprint samples when asked. These would later be used to tie him to the crime scene. When the evidence came back as a match, the detectives interviewed Thane once again. This time, he was repeatedly read his Miranda rights and told that he was not under arrest and was free to stop answering questions or ask for a lawyer. During the interview, Thane was offered food and given breaks. The detective said that Thane stuck to his original story that he had been in Jeffrey's house once for a beer 3 weeks before the murders. However, when presented with the evidence at the crime scene, Thane made a full, audible, and written confession. The detective said that Thane had been read his Miranda rights once again before writing out the confession. In fact, Thane had clearly stated, "Out of free will, I will give you what I want." And when told he didn't need to write the confession, he said, "Why the hell not?" According to the detective, during a break, Thane had asked him about what sort of punishment he may be facing for the murders and told him that the search for the killer was now over. At some point during the confession, Thane had said he would like to plead the fifth to some of the questions and at one point said, "Perhaps I do need a lawyer." Despite stating this, however, he continued to confess. His attorneys argued that this meant that the confession should be suppressed. During the hearing, his attorney also questioned Dr. Deborah Batter, chief forensic psychologist with the State Forensic Service, who did psychological testing on Thane. She characterized him as bright, but emotionally immature due to his traumatic and chaotic upbringing. She said that he was impulsive and appeared to suffer from episodic depression and despair, as well as generalized anxiety. It was the first time that anything regarding Thane's upbringing had been publicized. Ultimately, it would be decided that the statements that Thane made to detectives could be presented as evidence during trial. In October, Robert pleaded guilty to charges of hindering apprehension and arson. By pleading guilty, he acknowledged that he had helped Thane set fire to Jeffrey's car and dispose of the knife before driving him to New Hampshire. It was part of a plea agreement, and under the agreement, Robert would be facing 2 to 4 years in prison and would be testifying against Thane in his upcoming murder trial. He also pleaded guilty to aggravated furnishings of scheduled drugs and violation of bail, charges which had arose when he sold Oxycontin to his 24-year-old grandson while on bail. When the victim's family members learned of the plea agreement, they were furious. As Shannon said, "I can't tell you right now how angry I am." The family had not been informed of the plea agreement until the evening before the court hearing. Even more crushing, Robert was released on bail awaiting sentencing, and sentencing would not follow until after Thane's trial. The trial was scheduled to begin in April of 2012. Then in February, Thane's lawyers requested a change of venue for the trial based on pre-trial publicity. Assistant Attorney General Bill Stokes acknowledged that the case had received a lot of publicity, but said he still believed that an impartial jury could be found. In early April, jury selection for the murder trial began. If an impartial jury could not be found, then the trial could be moved. It was decided that an impartial jury could indeed be found, and they were seated, ready for trial to begin on the 8th of April. It had been 2 long years since the murders, and residents of Amity were ready to get the trial over and done with and put the grim chapter behind them. Thane's defense team would be arguing that he was not guilty by reason of insanity, while prosecutors would be contending that Thane was sane when he committed the murders. During opening statements, Deputy Attorney General William Stokes told the jury that Thane had made a list of names of people that he wanted to kill. There were 2 names on that list, Jeffrey Ryan and another man named Alvin Silsby. He said that Thin was not hallucinating when he committed the murders and knew all too well what he was doing.
He knew exactly what he was doing. He wasn't hallucinating, seeing pixies or pink elephants or hearing the voice of God.
Deputy Attorney Stokes said that on the evening of the 22nd of June 2010, Thin went to Jeffrey's home, but did not expect to find Jesse or Jason there. He said that Thin stabbed Jeffrey to death first while outside the home and then found Jason and Jesse on the couch playing video games. Here, he stabbed Jason in the chest before chasing Jesse down the hall and into the back bedroom. He explained to the jury that Jesse was stabbed as he cowered in fear. He was found dead on his hands and knees. After killing Jesse, Thin returned to the living room to realize that Jason had managed to get out of the home. However, he quickly followed him out the front door and repeatedly stabbed him in the back before slashing his throat with such force that he almost decapitated him. During the defense's opening statements, attorney James Dunleavy referred to the deaths as tragic, horrible, and horrific. His statement was extremely brief, but he told the jury that the defense would be putting into context the events of the night of the murders. Graphic testimony was presented very early on in the trial. Up until now, the only details that had been given surrounding the murders were what Thin had claimed had happened. Dr. Margaret DeWitt, the state medical examiner who conducted the autopsies, told the courtroom that all three victims had desperately attempted to escape their attacker. She described how all three had died from multiple stab wounds, and based on the positions their bodies were found in, each had tried to protect themselves. When shown a combat knife that prosecutors believed was the murder weapon, Dr. DeWitt said that the size and shape was consistent with the wounds inflicted on the victims. The knife had been a combat knife with a 7-inch blade. She took the jury through a walkthrough of the crime scene. She described how she first went into the back bedroom where she found the body of Jesse, partially blocking the door. His knees were tucked up under his body and his feet stuck out in a frog-like position. She said, "What was interesting was that he died right in that position. I could tell by the streams of blood down his back, sides, and face. It had dried that way and was not smeared, so he had not moved." She said that Jesse was completely vulnerable to the attack and his only defense was to turn away. Essentially, Jesse was trying to hide from the weapon to the best of his ability, but was unfruitful. She detailed how young Jesse had been stabbed 6 times in the back and once in the back of the head. As she used a diagram to detail the injuries, one juror started to cry. At least 2 of the wounds to Jesse's back had been so vicious that they went into his chest cavity and entered a lung. A 3rd stab wound had fractured Jesse's rib as it entered his chest cavity. She testified that any of those 3 wounds would have been fatal. From the back bedroom, Dr. DeWitt was taken to the body of Jeffrey. It had been found inside a chicken coop next to the woodshed beside the home. She testified that it appeared as though Jeffrey had crawled in underneath a shelf or bench inside the chicken coop in a bid to hide. She described how Jeffrey had been stabbed a total of 15 times, many of which were to the upper left side of his body. Several of the wounds entered his chest cavity and went into his lung. She also testified that Jeffrey had sustained defensive wounds, including 1 on his palm. Next, Dr. DeWitt examined Jason, whose body was found on the edge of Jeffrey's property. She told the jury that most of the wounds were to Jason's chest, but 1 to the back went through a lung and into his spleen. She also described how there was a cut to Jason's throat, just above the Adam's apple, and was cut the whole way down to the spinal cord. As the graphic description of Jason's injuries were read out, his father, Robert, abruptly left the courtroom. The last moments on earth for Jeffrey, Jesse, and Jason must have been filled with absolute terror. Detectives Elmer Farron and Jay Pelletier both testified about finding 3 half-empty beer cans and a half-smoked cigarette in the ashtray inside Jeffrey's home. The DNA from one of the cans and the cigarette butt were traced back to Thane. A videotape of the interviews between Thane and investigators was also played out during trial. The first videotape was from before Thane was linked to the murders with DNA. During the interview, Thane told investigators that he had met Jeffrey only once and had never met Jason or Jesse, and that he moved away the day after the murders, simply for work. He said that Tamar had suggested to him that either drug dealers or a biker gang may have been responsible for the murders. During the interview, he was calm, polite, and cooperative. It was during the second interview that Thane confessed to the murders. He stated, "I didn't try to be fancy. I wanted to be quick. Somewhere in the subconscious of my mind, I developed myself as an assassin." He divulged to the investigators that he wanted to kill both Jeffrey and the other man named Alvin, even though he had never met Alvin and did not know where he lived. He said that he believed that back in the day, Jeffrey, Alvin, and his own father were the biggest drug dealers in the area, and he wanted to rid the world of them. There was absolutely no evidence to substantiate Thane's claims. The night that Thane went to Jeffrey's house to kill him, he had pretended that he was looking for some nails. Jeffrey welcomed him into his home, offered him a beer, and then went out to the woodshed to retrieve the nails. It was here that Thane said he followed him and stabbed him multiple times as he turned away from him to show him the nails. During the interview, Thane said that after killing Jeffrey, he was in a mode and felt as though he needed to finish what he started. Evidence was presented regarding Thane's mental health and his childhood. Psychologist Diane Tennies testified that she had interviewed Thane when he was 12 years old. She said that he was depressed and had been abused by his mother. Furthermore, she said that there were reports that his mother had abused alcohol and drugs. Those in the courtroom, as well as locals and loved ones of the victims, were surprised when Robert wasn't called to the witness stand. The prosecutor declined to comment on why he was not called, and even the defense seemed surprised. During closing arguments, Deputy Attorney Stokes said, "What he told the detectives and what you heard him say is totally consistent with the evidence. The defendant thought he had silenced all of the victims." But now, almost 2 years later, the evidence speaks for Jeffrey Ryan, Jesse Ryan, and Jason DeHaan. During the defense's closing arguments, they suggested that Robert may have been responsible for the murders, but offered no evidence to corroborate their claims. Following all of the testimony, the jury were sent away to determine a verdict. It took them just 3 hours before finding Thane Ormsby guilty of 3 counts of first-degree murder, as well as 1 count of arson. After the verdict, the trial would be entering the second phase, which would involve testimony regarding the mental state of Thane. In Maine, a murder conviction carries a maximum sentence of life in prison. Those who are not deemed criminally responsible would be sent to a psychiatric hospital until they are deemed sane. Not guilty by reason of insanity was a defense that had been being used more often in Maine. According to data from the State Forensic Service in 2010, since 1946, a total of 118 people had been deemed not criminally responsible by reason of insanity. Such pleas were extremely rare before 2000, and when used, they were very rarely successful. During the hearing, Thane's attorney said that he met the criteria of being found not guilty by reason of mental defect or disease. The prosecution, however, denied that Thane had any kind of mental defect or disease. Assistant Attorney General Andrew Benson said that Thane did not suffer from hallucinations, delusions, or psychosis, and that his methodical actions after the murders supported the belief that he was sane. For example, Thane had attempted to clean up the crime scene, had burned his bloody clothing, and had thrown the knife used in the murders into a bog. The defense played out testimony from Dr. Diane Tennies, who could not be there in person because she had a prior commitment. Dr. Tennies said that Thane met the criteria for depressive disorder not otherwise specified, adding that at one point, he was a sad and anxious individual who aligned with troubled peers and engaged in risks to be accepted by others. She had been cross-examined and admitted that she had not treated Thane since he was 12 years old, and that he had not suffered from hallucinations, delusions, or psychosis. Thane's defence called on his estranged mother, Maria Ormsby, to testify. At times, Maria had difficulty answering questions and recalling events. She admitted that she had abused alcohol and drugs during Thane's upbringing. Jurors also heard from Dr. Catherine Thomas, a psychologist who examined Thane after the murders. She said that she had reached the conclusion that Thane was delusional at the time of the murders. She testified that he was out of touch with reality and thought he was ridding the world of a bad man and somehow boosting his own resume as an assassin. Assistant Attorney General Benson cross-examined Dr. Thomas and challenged it. He argued that Thane was very well aware of what he was doing when he committed the murders. He also said that he knew what he was doing was wrong and that he didn't want to be caught for it, hence killing Jesse and Jason, two witnesses. According to Dr. Thomas, it was Robert who told Thane that Jeffrey was a drug dealer. She also said that Robert had spoken to Thane about his time in Vietnam and had discussed killing people. Dr. Deborah Bader, chief forensic psychologist at the State Forensic Service, next took to the stand to refute Dr. Thomas's diagnosis. She had conducted a psychological evaluation on Thane. She acknowledged that he was not mentally healthy because of his chaotic and traumatic upbringing, during which he had been abused and neglected. She said that she did not believe that he was psychotic because of the series of rational actions he took following the murders. The jury would ultimately side with the prosecution and reject Thane's insanity defence. As the jury rendered their verdict, Thane stood expressionless. With the conviction secured, it was now time for Robert to be sentenced for his role in the case. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison with all but 4 years suspended, which meant that he would be serving just 4 years in prison. He also received 3 years probation and was forbidden from possessing drugs or alcohol. Robert turned to the victims' families and apologized for what he described as poor decisions, but said that he did not kill anybody. The judge accepted that Robert was older and was in ill health and very well could have felt confused and uncertain about what to do following the murders. However, he reiterated that he had ample opportunity to tell the truth. Following Robert's sentence, it was time for Thane to be sentenced.
For the murder of Jeffrey Ryan, it is my sad but solemn duty to sentence you to life in prison. For the murder of Jesse Ryan, it is my sad but solemn duty to sentence you to life in prison. And for the murder of Jason DeHaan, it is my sad but solemn duty to sentence you to life in prison.
He was handed down 3 life sentences, as well as a 15-year sentence on top of the life sentences for the arson conviction. Thane's lawyers immediately filed a notice of appeal, stating that they contended that Thane did not know what he was doing when he committed the murders. The Maine Supreme Judicial Court unanimously turned down the appeal, upholding his convictions and 3 life sentences. We will end this episode with a poignant poem that had been written by Jesse about his father and read out by his aunt during the victim impact statements.
He is nice for going hunting. Best of all, he's very kind for buying video games. But all I know now, he's the best friend I could ever have.
The shocking murders of Jeffrey Ryan, Jesse Ryan, and Jason DeHaan still reverberate within the small community of Amity today. According to federal statistics, Maine's overall murder rate is relatively low, but the state has the dubious distinction of having among the highest knife-killing rates in the entire country. While the murder of any child is completely abhorrent, for a child to die in such a terrifying and painful manner is completely crushing. The last moments of Jesse's life, in particular, as he cowered behind his bedroom door, is a thought too heartbreaking to bear. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I already said it at the start of this episode, but once again, a big thank you to my Patreon supporters. I'm eternally grateful for the support up there, but also just for the support of listening to an episode, commenting on an episode, sharing an episode with a friend. All of the support is very much appreciated. Can I also ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a podcast that you like and help new listeners find me. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing podcast, Forgotten News. Until next time, take care of yourself, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Wait a minute. Have you heard the strange and unusual stories of the Forgotten News podcast?
Hello, everyone. This is Jim.
This is Kit Karen.
We host the Forgotten News podcast.
On our show, we tell true stories from history, but not the stories you learned in school.
We tell stories that are obscure.
Mysterious.
Weird.
Wild.
For example,
the teenage girl who committed the last stagecoach robbery in the United States in 1899.
The really dumb gang of crooks who unintentionally kidnapped the lieutenant governor of Idaho in 1929.
The group of old ladies in 1893 who would secretly go out at midnight to catch stray cats and then, speed up their journey to heaven.
The farmer who vanished into thin air in front of witnesses, as he simply walked across his empty dirt yard in 1889.
So, on any given episode, our stories might be serious, silly, or sad.
But they will always be a true story.
So now you know pretty much everything about what to expect on the Forgotten News podcast.
We think you'll like it.
Thank you for listening.
Bye.